It's time for tech on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us. We're talking about posting photos on social media and how it relates to online privacy. Jesse LeGru is our guest. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, and he's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. And in addition to photo posting, Jesse will also talk about backing up your computer using digital banking apps and what to do after you've been scammed. And we want to hear your questions and comments. So join in. The number 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcome back, Jesse.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much for always joining us, taking time out of your busy, busy day. We appreciate it. So around this time of year, I've been seeing a lot of family pictures and whatnot on social media. How risky is it from like a privacy and security standpoint to share pictures of kids?
Yeah, there's overall privacy concerns, which I think people have had in terms of, you know, understanding where somebody lives. You know, people want to keep their information private, their locations a little bit more private. Usually it's more about the individual themselves, but you know, when you share any kind of picture, it's possible to share information about somebody else that you really didn't intend. And with children, it can be even a little bit more risky. One, because at least from my standpoint, the child doesn't really have consent in terms of sharing that information. And it's unknown what will be done with any of those images or any of that content, you know, in the next day, the next week, the next decade. With the use of artificial intelligence and a lot of other tools that are available out there, you know, we've all heard about deepfakes, whether it's for pictures or video or audio, it's possible to use that technology with even one single image that's shared today as well. And that could put any individual in any of those images really up for that possibility of being deepfaked and being put into a situation that otherwise wasn't intended. And, you know, in many cases, it's really difficult to kind of make an argument of, well, this is fake. You know, how do you really know? And there are a variety of other ways to do it. But sometimes when an image is out there, whether it's real or not real, that can be pretty much impossible to take back. And so that can put individuals at risk, especially children, but really anyone sharing any kind of image online.
Very true. It's kind of funny because as I get a lot of friend requests from guys that are extremely good looking and usually in the military. And the other day I got one that looked suspiciously like Paul Hollywood. So you just never know, right? People borrow pictures all the time. Yep. So how much control do we have over our kids' digital footprint, you know, once it's created, once it's out there?
Yeah, the amount of control as soon as everything is out there is pretty limited. So depending on how content is shared, there are some capabilities to remove it from whatever platform you're using. So let's say it's Facebook or Instagram or, you know, Google Photos. So maybe you're sharing content in a variety of different ways. There are usually ways to remove that content from the source, but it can be really challenging after that point. So you don't know who else shared it, who downloaded it, was it archived by a different third-party provider, and then potentially out there for everyone until the end of time. It's really difficult to know. And so a lot of that also is really about the sharing settings that individuals have. So, you know, with most tools, you have the capability, how public is this information? Is it only my friends? Is it my friends' friends? Is it really no one unless I decide to make that information public? So I think making sure sharing settings are appropriate and as limited as they can be is always going to be helpful. But there's always, you know, the paranoid side behind everything is, well, even if I'm not sharing that content with any of the individuals that I'm connected with on this platform, what is the vendor doing? Are they using these images or downloading or sharing them in some other way that I'm not aware of that could also really create the same risk? a lot of the terms of service for many of these platforms, you might be agreeing to information or sharing of data that otherwise you really wouldn't want to. So being mindful of all of those pieces is really important. My biggest recommendation for anyone who's very, very privacy oriented and very, very concerned about their information is, well, one, when you put it out there, just expect it to be public. It's going to be probably made available in some way, shape, or form. And if you wouldn't want it out there, just don't post it.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Hard to follow sometimes, but so what can we do if we've already posted those pictures? Should we go in and take them down, or should we change the privacy settings? I mean, what do you recommend we do?
Yeah, I always recommend, with it, just about any platform that you're using, especially if you're using it more often or there's a little bit more private information, social media tends to be one of those areas, especially platforms like Facebook. Check your security settings regularly. A lot of those privacy and security settings change. Either features get added or maybe they get taken away. And so understanding what those new features are, how you might be able to better limit or even more widely share information is really useful to know. So I would say regularly do that, just to make sure you know what your settings are and that you're sharing the data in the way that you want to. If you don't want the data up there, delete it, remove it. And I think that's another interesting point too, is I think just as individuals might want to share information about their children or maybe their family, other people might be wanting to share information about you as well. Maybe you don't want that information shared. Maybe you don't want it easily accessible. And while you can't really control what other people are doing with that information, there are some things you can do. For example, Facebook, you can remove the availability for people to tag you in photos. So it's a little bit harder for people to find. And so you at least have some control on how people can find the information. You can request the removal of content if it was not put up by yourself or you really wanted that deleted. That could be through Facebook. It could be through Instagram. Depending on the platform, unfortunately, there's a different form for a different request. And so if you really do want to go through and remove a lot of information, it's a lot of work to actually go through and submit a lot of those forms, collect all of the information you need in terms of the content that you want to remove, and then really wait for that content to be deleted or otherwise not made accessible. And even if all of that is done, it's still possible somebody downloaded. It's possible it was archived and available in a search engine or was made available from a different third party. So even with all the best solutions in place, it's still limited. That data might still be out there. It really is one of those items where once it's out, it's out. It's hard to completely remove it. The best you can do is kind of reduce the likelihood someone's going to run into that content.
And as far as our privacy settings, when we go, do we go to our profile? Is that where those are? We can find those options?
Yeah, if you go to, most of the time in Facebook is going to be similar. A lot of them are going to be similar. Usually it's going to be in a security or a separate privacy section. So underneath your profile, you're going to see a lot of the settings in there. Facebook is actually extremely detailed. So outside of content that you might be sharing with Facebook that is a little bit more intentional, so images, text, whatever it might be, you actually have other data you're sharing with Facebook, whether you might be realizing it or not, including what you're clicking on, different ads that you're interacting with or getting promoted to your feed. So those settings are in there as well. And so you can modify not only that data that you're intentionally sharing when you hit that share button or post button, but also some of the data that's interacting with your profile or your feed. So I recommend taking a look at those as well. It can be a lot to go through, but it's well worth at least understanding what happens. Because even though you may not see the settings in other platforms, it's likely a lot of that is happening, even if you don't have that easy option to change what that setting is, just because a lot of vendors will share data with third parties for a variety of different reasons, and they just tend to be in those terms of service that most individuals just really don't have the time to read, or that it's really complicated to understand.
It really isn't too bad once you've done it, like on Facebook. I know I've checked that out a few times. It's not too bad once you know where to go. So just put in the time. We got an email from Katie in New Berlin. Her computer screen is flickering really fast, giving her a headache. Oh, I hate that. It's a monitor separate from the actual computer. What could need to be replaced?
That's a good question. So it depends on the display. There are usually a few things I would try just to see, you know, is it the computer? Is it the display? Is it the cable? The first thing I would try is if you have another monitor, whether it's yours or somebody else's, plug your computer into a different display. Does it do the same thing? If it does, it actually might be your laptop versus the display. If it's the display itself, it could be a backlight. Which for most displays, there's not a lot of organizations that will repair them. Usually it's a replacement kind of thing. With a lot of laptops, if they do have backlights, they can be replaced or repaired. With an actual standalone monitor, that might be a little bit more challenging. So it's possible that the display itself might need to be replaced. But the first thing I do is just try it in a different display. You might even be able to go to a store and actually just use one of the demos. They might allow you to, and then you can actually determine what the issue is. And a lot of those stores actually might have repair centers that are willing to either do that for a very small fee, let's say we'll test it and give you an idea of what it might be, or, you know, give you maybe even a quick free, just plug it in if you have an issue. They might be able to give you options too of, with this display, what they might be able to do. But I haven't actually looked into it and understanding whether you could actually get an LCD repaired. Most things you can, I just haven't, I really haven't seen it before. The laptops themselves, yes, and the backlights with those displays, yes. With the standalone LCDs, I just haven't seen it too much. I would not be surprised if there was a company out there doing it. I just haven't seen it.
Could it be it's just a bad cord?
It could be a bad cord too. So, and that's the other reason, you know, plugging it into a different display is also a good idea. And if it's most displays, and this is where it could be a bit more challenging, different displays have different cables. And so you may have a cable laying around you can use, you may not. With a newer laptop, they tend to use HDMI, which is also pretty universal with TVs. So you might actually be able to plug in your computer into a TV, see if you get the same behavior, and if that monitor that the individual has also uses HDMI, you might be able to use that same cable and swap it. And so it gives you a different capability to test that out. But it really does depend on the monitor that you're using, whether you have a different plug. But in most cases, they're usually really easy to find. But that's one reason, you know, if you have a friend that has another display, plug it in, because they're going to have a different cable plugged into it anyway. And then you might be able to swap in your cable too. So that's another good thing to try, because if it is just a cable, that's really easy to fix.
Yeah, I've run into that a couple of times, not in a monitor, but cables going bad. So it's the first thing I think of. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and Clara Neipert is our producer today. Tyler Ditter is our technical director. Do you have a tech question? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're talking tech with Jesse LeGru today on the Larry Mueller Show. Jesse is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And we'll go right to the phones because we have a caller who has a comment on our last question. Patrick in Madison, go ahead.
Hi. Another problem or another solution to the problem may be that the computer needs a driver update for the monitor or a BIOS update, because frequently Windows will put out updates and your hardware is capable of running them, but if you have an older driver, it can cause problems.
Comment, Jesse?
Yeah, it's a good suggestion. Yeah, there could be a variety of things, both hardware and software, causing the issue. And so making sure software, whether it's software for your operating system or for the hardware on your device, is always a good idea. So making sure everything is updated. It's another reason to do updates, because ideally it's going to help when you run into issues, or at least understand what the issue might not be. Great suggestion.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. Let's take another email. This one's from Jerry. He said he's heard that the 3-2-1 rule for backing up of he's heard of the 3-2-1 rule for backing up computers, but he has no clue what that means. Could you please explain? Have you heard of it, Jesse? He's frantically looking it up.
Yeah, I am frantically looking it up because it's generally not something that I've really thought about. It's probably something I've thought about, but never actually put a terminology to.
Sure.
So, and it's really talking about how you back up your data. So, for example, if you have one backup of data, let's say I have a hard drive that I plug into my device, I back up my data to my hard drive. Really, is that good enough? Well, if the hard drive and the laptop or desktop are in the same location and there's a fire, it may not be, because you could lose the backup and you could lose the primary storage. So you wouldn't have that information. And the idea behind the 3-2-1 backup strategy is having three copies of data. So production data and two backup copies, and also having the backup copies on different media. So what you're really trying to do is to better protect any of those backup mechanisms failing. If I do have backups in three different medias, but still housed in the same location without a fireproof safe, and there happens to be some kind of, you know, natural disaster or occurrence, you know, that could be destroyed. And that's one of the reasons where when we think about backups, it's great to have a hard drive backup. If it's in the same location, you know, maybe the risk is low if you don't have other factors, but to reduce the risk, you can do other things. Store it in a safe deposit box. Have it in a more controlled area where, you know, no one can get access to it. And I think that's another risk outside of just losing the backup. What if someone breaks into your house or your apartment and steals that backup drive, and that backup drive is not encrypted, and somebody could read all the information? Well, now they have all of your data. So those are all the kind of things to think about when considering how to back things up. At least for me, when I think about backing up on different media, I just, you know, try to make sure I plan for my backup to fail a little bit as well. So I do have my primary device. I do have a backup hard drive that everything is stored on, but I also have another backup hard drive that other things are stored on. It's actually online versus offline. The benefit of having it online is I can make frequent backups regularly, and that offline backup I can do once a month, once a week, whenever I would like to do it. The downside with online backups is it's also something somebody could attack. And that can be a challenge even when we talk about ransomware and a lot of infections and corporate compromises. If somebody's able to access your backups, they might be able to delete your backups and then, you know, do something to your device. And if that happens, then you don't have anything. So that offline backup is extremely important. And so I do recommend have something offline, or at least have something that really no one can access without either needing specific physical requirements, like you need to be in a specific room on a specific data jack. There are a lot of things you can do to it, but having that offline backup at least make sure that if somebody breaks into something else, doesn't mean your data can't be leaked, but it means even if they delete all your data, you can get back to it somehow. So it really is kind of that defense in depth strategy of have contingency plans, not just have one backup. Consider, well, what happens if that backup fails? What happens if they're all stored in the same location and something bad happens? How do you really increase the chances you're going to be able to get that information back? and many people will do that. And this is not just people, but companies will do this too. Hey, I have my backup and I want to make sure it's safe. Can I give you one of my backup copies? So if something happens, I know I can get to it. And so you might have a friend or a neighbor. You can actually help each other by maybe storing a backup copy. So if somebody needs it, you know, you have it if something really, really bad happens. So really it's about contingency planning and making sure that, you know, any of those risks, even though they may be pretty low, if and when it does happen, you have a strategy to get that data back.
Well, as somebody who accidentally knocked a hard drive off a table and ruined someone's years of pictures, I understand completely about that third backup. Yeah, so you never know. It's best to be prepared. So for those of people who are listening are thinking, okay, this is a great idea. How do I do it? How do you even start with doing the backup?
Yeah, there are a lot of options. And there are a lot of online options you can use to back up your data. There are a lot of services like Dropbox that you can get additional storage. So the first thing with anyone, if they're considering backups, how much data do you have? Some people don't really have a lot. You can fit pretty much everything you need onto a flash drive. Pretty inexpensive, low amount of physical space needed to do it. And it could just be buying a couple flash drives, making sure you have, you can either just drag and drop the files if you know what you need. Do that a couple times a month, maybe give it to somebody in case, you know, something happens where you physically are. I think that could be a really, really easy strategy if you don't have a lot of data. If you do have a lot of data, that could still be a strategy. It's just the flash drives are a lot more expensive. But if it is a little bit more complicated where you don't just want to back up a specific folder, but you want to back up your entire operating system, everything that's running on your device. So if something bad happens, you can restore everything. You know, Windows has a built-in backup mechanism you can use with external hard drives or flash drives. Mac OS also has options with Time Machine to do backups in a variety of different ways. So most of the built-in operating systems are going to have some kind of backup utility. It's just giving them the storage that they need so you can back it up.
So if you go to your computer and search backup options, will that pop up for you? Or is it a little more complicated than that?
Luckily, now it's a little bit easier than it used to be in the past. But yeah, it should be as easy as looking for backup. With newer versions of Windows, usually you can go into the start menu, just type in backup. It's automatically going to find the options for the built-in backup utility. With Mac OS, it's also going to be similar. If you use Spotlight Search, you can find backups or Time Machine and look for basically the settings you need to turn on those backup features. If it's a much older system, it might be a bit more complicated. And that's where people may also want to look into those third-party services. So sometimes the flash drives or hard drives you find in the store, they might actually have a backup utility that's included with them. So if you don't want to use the utility that's built into your computer, you might be able to use something that's actually supplied by the third party where you're actually getting your hard drive from. And I've actually seen that. I've upgraded my laptop hard drives before because I needed more storage. They actually had a nice little backup utility and a license that was included with it where I could actually transition not just the full files and folders, but my entire operating system to this new hard drive. So it effectively allowed me to make a full system backup and then restore it. And so that's another option. Those backup drives may come with utility you can use. They might allow you to schedule it. And so as long as you have access to that storage, you can go ahead and send your data in that direction. It'll make sure that everything is backed up, and it might be able to give you an alert. Hey, by the way, your backup failed or this is what happened. And so you can find those features both online where like cloud options like Dropbox or For, you know, physical devices you have like in your hand or in your home.
Okay. If you've got a tech question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And, of course, we'll take emails, and that's ideas@WPR.org. What about our phone, Jesse? Should we be backing up our phones? We do so much on it these days.
Yeah, and that's another good question. So, and it depends on the phone. So a lot of phones, especially if you have an up-to-date one that is connected to a variety of other services, some people like that, some people don't like that. And we, as we talked about the sharing, for example, a lot of the more automated backups means you're sharing your data with a third party, which could be used for something else. If you have an Apple phone, if you have an Android phone, you're usually connected to the Apple suite of products, you know, iCloud and iCloud backup, or you might have Google services for Android phones and actually have built-in backups there, because it will back up your contacts, it'll back up photos using Google Photos. The same thing goes with your iPhone as well. So if you don't have an Android or an iPhone, that's going to be a little bit different. So depending on the phone that you have, the solution is likely going to be a little bit different in those cases. I do recommend backing them up if you want the data. So that's the biggest question is, if that device fails, what do you feel you need? And I think with a phone, outside of photos, which I think is going to be extremely important because our smartphones become those devices that otherwise we used to buy a separate device for. We buy a camera, you get a roll of film, you get it developed, you have it printed out. But if you're taking photos on your phone, what happens if that phone dies? Are those photos backed up somewhere else? Do you have them stored somewhere else? A lot of those services are, once again, they can automatically be backed up somewhere else. So it may not be an issue. Same thing with contacts, but when I think of phones, contacts is probably one of those items that's going to be a little bit more challenging to get back. But in many cases, once again, those are also synchronized. So I do recommend backing it up just because our smartphones tend to be one of the most, if not the most important devices we probably use on a day-to-day basis, because they're not only small computers that we can do just about everything we would do on our normal desktop or laptop, but we use it more frequently. We're using it to communicate with people on a regular basis, whether it's text messages, using social media applications, or anything else. I think the outside of contacts, text messages might be another interesting thing people are interested in, because those may not be automatically backed up or otherwise accessible unless you do something else to back those up. Once again, iCloud and the Google features have different ways for you to store some of that data or to also broadcast that information to multiple devices. For example, iMessage, you can actually have a lot of devices hooked up at the same iCloud account. And all of a sudden, instead of just getting one notification, you're getting five from five yes. different devices all hooked up to the same account. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about that is, well, you have the data that you can access from different devices. So it doesn't matter if one of them fails, you have the way to retrieve it. It's in your iCloud account and you can access it that way. So the short answer is yes, but most of the time, if you have an up-to-date device, you have the feature turned on. It just depends whether you want to use that built-in service, which is usually really, really easy to use. If you don't want to use those services, it gets a bit more complicated. You can install third-party applications that allow you to back it up to other storage locations. A lot of devices will also have the ability to have like a micro SD card where you can store backups or take it out. Not all phones have that though. So that can be limiting as well. Usually you need some kind of online backup option where you're going to be storing it to some third party, whether it's going to be Apple, Google, or maybe a third party storage provider, which could be Dropbox or other options that are mm-hmm. out there.
Mm-hmm. And it comes in handy, too, when you buy a new phone, because if it's the same one, it's so easy to transfer the data back and forth. So that's a plus, too. Betty emailed us, and she said that when you're scrolling through Facebook, does it track the amount of time you spend just looking at an ad, not even clicking on it? Because she doesn't click on ads. She just looks at them. But then she gets more of the same kind. Been there, done that. So are they looking at eyeballs, Jesse?
Yes, generally, yes. Mm-hmm. So they want to know what's on the screen and what kind of stays there. So what's really focusing attention? And that could be Facebook and that could be other services too. So I think there's that interesting in tracking user behavior. So what catches your eye and what keeps you occupied? And I think there's other information in terms of how that's done, both for advertising and other items. But I would anticipate, especially with social media, most behaviors are being tracked to understand really how to kind of how to market to you. One of the items that's brought up is curating the experience for a person. So really, you know, we'd like to make the experience better for you. One way to do that is to understand how you use your device, what you find interesting. Once we know that, we can supply you with content that's going to keep you kind of occupied or keep you interested in what you're taking a look at. Others might say that's a little bit more predatory in terms of trying to maybe sell you things that otherwise you wouldn't get, but you're still interested in it anyway. So you can take a different perspective on it. But yeah, short answer is yes, they're interested in what interests you.
That's right. And Jim emailed us, can a USB drive be restored? The post has been bent and disengaged from the main rectangular unit, you know, the little thing that sticks out, and no longer displays the photos or info.
And short answer is usually yes. So there are a lot of different, there's a range of things you can do with kind of data recovery of devices. If it's a pin on a USB key that's bent, it's actually very likely you can actually get the data off of it or send it to an organization that can easily make it so you can access that data. You can actually get, kind of build your own USB kits where you can actually put those together. I enjoy woodworking, so I've actually seen people create like nice wood USB keys in there and taking it apart. When you look at a USB key, they have four pins, two are read, two are write. All you really need to do is make sure those, the right pins hit the right things on your device you're reading it from, and you can read the data. Assuming there's no other problem with the chip itself and the data that's stored on it, if it's simply that pin, it should be relatively straightforward to have someone else take a look and read the data from it. I do recommend have somebody who's has experience doing that to actually do that work. Otherwise, I would say plan or expect that you may not be able to get the data back. Because especially when looking at any kind of electrical component, you connect the wrong things, bad things can happen. So if you are interested in trying to get that data back, go to an area that's a little bit more specialized in data recovery or has at least talked about some experience doing that. But if it is just a pin, that's actually really easy. And somebody with the right knowledge should hopefully be able to get you that data.
Okay, well, that's good news for you, Jim. Ross in Middleton emailed. He asked if you could address password security applications. For example, there's one, LastPass, of course, we've talked about before, and he thinks the better ones have a subscription fee. Is it worth it? There was a real basic one that he downloaded, but he doesn't know if it is really by itself is very secure.
Yeah, so that's a good question. It kind of overlaps with kind of the backup security as well a little bit. So I think for anyone, having a password manager is a good idea. It's just too challenging to remember a password. Whether you're trying to do it online or offline, I think is a good question. Online, it's on the internet. Could somebody break into your account and get access to your vault, right? And get access to your passwords. It's a possibility. So that's a risk other people might not be interested in. Usually those are going to be the ones that have the subscription fee. You're going to be paying either additional features or just the right to access the service. In most cases, when you're paying for something, you're usually getting something for the money that you're actually supplying. And the same can be said for like virtual private network or VPN clients. Usually if you're paying for something, you're getting a little bit faster speed, you're getting more options, or you're getting better service. So when taking a look at just about anything online, I tend to be a little bit more suspicious of the free products because those tend to be the one that either don't have security in place to protect the content that you have, or they're using the data that is being supplied in some way that you may not want. For most password managers, for example, you know, you're supplying websites and you're supplying usernames and passwords. Could the websites you're going to be supplied to other third parties to understand your behavior? If it's a free product, it's a possibility, or it's more likely some of that data is going to be used to generate revenue with other third parties than not. So usually when you pay for something, you're going to get something from it. Always read the terms of service. I think it's a good habit, at least to understand usually that third party data sharing. What's happening with my information? Is it being shared with anyone else intentionally? Regardless if anyone breaks into a system, do I know if that data is going somewhere else? So for me, I do recommend probably leaning towards paid options because you're going to get better features. You're generally going to get better maintenance and security for the data you're providing or the services you're depending on. Can you depend on them being operational when you need them? If they're free, they don't really have a whole lot. It's like, well, it's free. How much can you expect? When you're paying for something, you have a little bit more expectation of, is that going to be available when I need it? And are they going to be doing the right things to make sure that my data is safe? The other thing I always recommend, just make sure the organization is legitimate, because there's also a lot of phishing websites out there that just simply want to find ways to collect revenue, collect passwords. So could there be a fake phishing website out there supplying a service that sounds great and is a subscription, but tends to be fraud instead? So those are some things to keep in mind. So it's another reason I tend to take a look at reviews or other third-party articles to better understand what my options are and can actually do comparisons between different products. I think those are really useful. And I tend to look at least two different sources just to make sure I'm not missing anything.
Mm-hmm. Our expert today is Jesse LeGru. He is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. What tech questions are you dealing with right now? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. We're talking about tech today. Jesse, just before we went to that break, we were talking about password security. I just had a follow-up question on that. So if I'm in Google's search engine and I'm at a website and I'm putting in a password and username and it asks me to save it, is that a good option?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with whether it's whatever browser you might have, a lot of web browsers or smartphones have the option to save passwords. You're going to get probably a variety of different answers on this one. So generally anything in a web browser where it's stored locally on your device, generally the recommendation is not to use built-in password managers, primarily due to the risk of phishing emails or malicious links that might be navigated to on accident. They might be able to get access to browser information that could include saved passwords or other content, unless they're protected in a certain way. And usually with other browsers, they've had like master passwords that you can set, which will ensure that your data, those passwords being used for different websites are encrypted. So even if anyone got access to your browser data, they may not be able to read that information. But anytime when there is data that the web browser needs to read. Usually it's going to be in an unencrypted format that it can be used to access that data. So I generally don't recommend putting it directly into browsers. I would recommend using a third-party utility just because there can be some challenges with those, the storage. There are a lot of different examples you can kind of bring. If you have somebody's web browser profile data, you can actually easily load that onto a different machine. And the nice thing about that, having a backup of your browser profile is, you know all the tabs you have open, you have your browser history. You know, we talked about backups. How many people, and I haven't done this in a long time, but if you lost all your favorites, how would that feel? And so having that profile backup can be useful, but that also might include those passwords. And it's actually really easy to unhide those passwords and to read that information. And so to really better protect it, it's recommended use a third-party utility, use something else. Usually your browser can read that information. There might be a plugin or extension. There might still be some risk depending on how that extension is developed or what that how that third-party product works. But I usually recommend don't use the built-in ones, use something else, because there's going to be, if your browser gets hijacked for any reason, because you click on the wrong link, which is easy to do, some of that information could be exposed and you definitely don't want that.
Fine, I'll change it. It's just so useful. Let's go to Tom in Hartford. He has a question. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. The question I have is I have an older iPad Air, and I'm running out of memory on it. It's got 128 gigabytes of memory. And with one of the apps that I use for recording, I always get pop-ups that say running low on memory. And when I go into the settings menu and look at what's taking up most of the memory in my iPad, there is a gray area that's labeled other that I cannot find that file anywhere. The only thing I can think of is maybe it might be some kind of cache or something. And I'm wondering if there's anywhere to clear that out of there because it seems to be taking up an awful lot of memory on my iPad.
Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the time when you're taking a look at the storage, and other tends to be the non-standard storage locations that you might have data in. It could be third-party applications, or it could be other data. What I'd probably take a look at, and this might be a bit more challenging, once you're in the settings for your iPad, you can actually look application by application to determine how much storage each application is taking up. That might be one thing to take a look at because you're going to be able to see it in a different way. At least on mine, when I do take a look, I do get it by application. But some of it might also be other system data or cache information that could be downloaded. There might be some application updates that could also be there. But that would be the first place that I would take a look. Depending on the version of iOS that you have on your device, you might have actually more limited information in terms of what you can see because some of the options made available by Apple could only be in later versions of the operating system. But they could also just be other unused data. For example, on mine, they have an offload unused apps. You might be able to actually turn off and delete some unused storage if you do want to take a look in there. But that's probably the first place I take a look to see if you can do anything. If you do have backups, so if you're still able to use iTunes to do a full system backup, you could potentially do a full backup and do a restore. Generally, a restore will kind of start your system off from scratch with all the same applications. I think it's been a while, but I know in the past, there's generally been a little bit better performance. You're kind of starting out a little bit more from scratch and you kind of get a fresh system. That could be another way to try to clear up information. but it is likely there's just other temporary information used by browsers or other information. You could try closing out of all of your apps, restarting your device to see if it reclaims some more of the information. But those would be the big things. Otherwise, I'd try to go app by app and just see if there's anything you don't need that you can get removed and put into another location. There are probably some better ways to do it, but it might be a little bit more complicated because you actually can take a backup using iTunes, and there are ways to navigate those backups where you can actually piece together some of the more specific data or even better understand where some of that data is being stored. But unfortunately, if you don't see it really in the iOS interface, you actually might want to look for a third-party application in the App Store, which might be able to give you a little bit more information. I haven't used any myself, and whenever I look to downloading a new app, I'm always a little bit careful because you just never quite know if it's, you know, malicious or not, if it's dangerous. Usually Apple tends to be pretty good about vetting applications that are in the App Store and what they can do. But that could be another option, is you might be able to find an app in the App Store that can give you more detailed information that just for whatever reason is not as easy to find in the built-in interface.
Okay. Good luck, Tom. Amy from Milwaukee emailed us. She wants to know if a picture is only shared between text messaging in your contact list and you know these people won't further share it and it's not on any social media platform, is it as risky that someone unknown to you can still get the picture?
It's probably less risky. It depends on how the information shared. And I'm sure others have kind of had this interesting behavior in the past. If you're using an iPhone, you have the option to do SMS messaging or you have the option to do iMessage. Both are very different. And actually, if you're regularly texting or sending content to other individuals that aren't iPhone or iOS users, you kind of get different behavior. It's a little weird. But iMessage is different than SMS. And iMessage, you actually might be able to view it online if somebody's able to kind of compromise somebody else's account. Generally, SMS, I'm not going to say it's more secure because SMS is also not secure, or it has its own issues if people are trying to break into a cell phone. But if you don't have it online and it's just stored on your device and stored on somebody else's device, I mean, the chances are much lower than somebody's going to break into a device, into a service online. They're going to break into an iCloud account and be able to see it. It's going to be resident on your device. That being said, check your settings for your device as well. I know most devices will have options, especially if you have different applications installed, to back up your text messages, which might include photos. Once you start using those features, which can be good if a device fails, it can also be a risk if somebody's able to break into those services, because most of those are going to be online. They're going to be more publicly available. People may need your username and password, so that's always a good protection. Also, multi-factor authentication, enable it if you haven't. But the chances are much lower if it's only in one-to-one messaging rather than being posted on social media. It's much more difficult for somebody to get into that information, and likely they're actually going to really, it's going to be a more of a targeted attack to try to get that data. So keep that sharing circle small, and that's going to keep it much smaller than putting it on basically a public service.
Sure. And here's a quick one before we go to break. A listener emailed and they need to recycle an Epson XP 5100 series printer. Is there any data stored on these printers? For example, past print jobs, they're worried about ID theft.
That's a good question. So depending on the printer, and this is usually what's recommended for larger multifunction printers that are generally a little bit more centralized in like larger offices, because they will have hard drives where they will store jobs where people can retrieve them or print them. For most consumer grade printers, it's probably less an issue in terms of being able to see the data that's stored. Generally, it's stored as long as it's printed. It's only in memory. It's not on a physical hard drive that somebody's going to be able to access. And usually when that memory is unpowered, the data is lost. So it's going to be very unusual for somebody to get good information from a standard home printer or all-in-one device. If you had a larger device that actually has a hard drive, something really a little bit more expensive that's meant for an office, that's going to be a different story, because those will have additional ways to get information. But I'd say for most consumer grade hardware, it's probably going to be okay. If there is more of a concern, and if you're just trying to recycle it because you want to make sure that the parts don't end up in a landfill, that they're disposed of responsibly, you could also take some of it apart.
Okay. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We'll be back to take more of your questions right after this break for the news. Stay with us. This is the Larry Mueller Show, and we're talking about technology today with our regular guest expert, Jesse LeGrue. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Jesse is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he assists in establishing and implementing strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data and reduce institutional risk. Now, what questions do you have on your mind about tech? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we have all of our lines open. So if you've got a question, give us a call. Jesse, we wanted to talk about Google. Okay, so we wanted to talk about wallets, digital wallets, Apple Pay, Google Pay, that kind of a thing. First of all, just explain what they are for those who haven't used them before.
Yeah, and so Google Pay and Apple Pay, they really allow you to link up an existing payment method, potentially multiple different credit cards, so you can easily check out, especially if you're physically at a store. And they might be using a variety of wireless technologies, usually near-field communications, otherwise known as NFC. So you can just tap and pay, kind of a similar tap and pay that you would actually use for most physical cards that people are getting today. Usually, rather than the kind of the standard credit card with just the swipe, most will also now have the chip. And they'll also have that method to wirelessly tap and pay. And so it really allows you to do the same thing. But then rather than supplying a card number every time, which kind of like a password, anytime you supply information, the more that information is at risk, because you're kind of putting it out there for somebody to read. They're generally giving out a one-time token that if somebody gets, it's only going to be usable for that one transaction, that no one can really do anything with that information. And it helps to protect against fraud. So it allows for some convenience. It allows for a little bit better security in terms of what can somebody do with that information. And for, you know, most people that just want to buy something, especially during times like COVID, you don't necessarily have to hand over information. It allows you to easily pay while actually still maintaining like social distancing, where you can easily pay and don't have to have like physical interactions in the same way with traditional cards where you'd have to hand it over.
And it's nice if you forgot your card, you can always use your phone because you're less likely to forget that, right?
Yes.
As far as security goes, do we have to worry about having that stored in our phone?
Overall, you shouldn't have to worry about the information stored on the device itself. At some point, you know, it does have to read information to better understand how to link up your account and how it's going to deliver the tokens to whatever vendor you're paying for any kind of service for. But usually it's going to be storing only information that's usable for singular transactions, and it shouldn't be storing the credit card number that you can actually retrieve from the device itself. I think one other risk people are concerned about is, if I can simply go up to a device and tap, does that mean somebody can tap my device and take my credit card information? That's the other benefit about using these one-time tokens is, if they're able to get that, it's really available and usable for one-time use only. And it doesn't actually have the information that could be used to do another online transaction. So most individuals will try to steal credit card information so they can go to a website or use some other mechanism to make a payment. If you don't have the credit card number, you don't have the expiration date, you don't have the CVV number, usually on the back of the card, you really can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it does help to protect against those types of fraud.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell that you can use it because there's an app already on the phone, or can you download an app to do that?
Generally, I would only use the applications built into your device. There are probably other third-party applications you can install if you need. I think the thing I'm always worried about with those is, what information are they reading, and how can you make sure they're legitimate? So I just want to make sure that the options you're using are legitimate. Those legitimate options are usually going to be built into your phone anyway. So Apple Pay, for example, is built into iOS. It's available. You can use it, the same thing with an Android. Google Pay is also available. You can use it for credit cards. They also, actually, if you buy tickets online, they will actually use the same thing. So Google Wallet, you can actually, I think we went to like a dinosaur exhibit thing in Milwaukee, and we actually got the tickets online, and it went to Google Wallet. So a lot of those applications are used for other things too. So it's kind of nice to use those built-in options for not just credit cards, but for other tickets.
Yeah, airline tickets too. I always download them onto mine, and I love it. Well, let's go to the phone. We've got a few callers, and Don in Bayfield, you're up next.
Say hi. I've got a smartphone, and it doesn't work anymore. I cannot turn on, doesn't work. So I've got like 75 photos. Is there any way I can transfer those to my new cell phone?
And it sounds like the phone does not power on at all currently. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. It's a possibility, but it's very likely you'd actually need to go into a repair center to see if they can get any of the data out. If it is an older device, there may be a micro SD card or external storage. Usually they're going to have a slot that's covered up by usually kind of a little bit of rubber. It tends to be kind of by the power button or by the volume buttons. If there is a device in there, you might be able to take that out and the photos may be on there. But more likely than not, it's probably on the storage, on the phone itself. And if it doesn't turn on, somebody would actually try to need to take the phone apart. And even then, I don't know what would be required to actually get the data off that storage, assuming that the storage is functional. So I don't think it's going to be something easily you're going to be able to get off yourself. So I would actually just ask any kind of computer repair store. If they can't do it, they'll likely have contacts for organizations that might be able to do it, to see if they can get any data off. But it's going to be extremely challenging if you can't turn it on. You need to really go to an expert.
Okay, thank you, Don. Next up, Connie in Oshkosh. What can we help you with?
Hi, I compose letters on Libre on my computer, and then I save them. And after a while, they get old, and I want to delete them. And I cannot delete anything out of, the saved folder that I have stored these various documents in.
Are you using a Windows computer or a Mac or something else?
Windows.
Okay. It sounds like you're using LibreOffice, which is a great option. It's a great open source Office application. It's likely a lot of those documents are sitting in your documents folder. Usually that's where it's going to be storing your data by default. What I'd recommend doing is going into within Microsoft Windows, it's going to be called Windows Explorer. And usually there's going to be an icon on your desktop. If not, you can go into your start menu and type in Explorer. And usually it's going to give you an option to open it up. And on the left-hand side, it'll show some common folders. One of those is going to be documents. My guess is that it's going to be sitting in that documents folder, and you can delete it from there. LibreOffice may still show when you go to the open dialog menu or when you go to recent files, it may still show those options in that menu. But if you have deleted it from your documents folder, when you try to click on it, it'll basically tell you, oh, I can't find that file. So Windows Explorer is going to be the option to take a look. If you can't actually find those files, for whatever reason, you can't find the documents folder or you can't find the files in the documents folder, usually in Windows Explorer, there's going to be a search option. So it'll allow you to search for your whole computer to see if you can find that file with that file name. And so even if you can't find it easily, it should allow you to search for those files and then remove them from your computer.
Okay, thank you, Connie. Frank in Wausau has a question. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi. I appreciate your taking the time to talk about online safety and privacy and so forth. I was wondering what your thoughts were on some of the browsers like DuckDuckGo, and I think another one is Brave, and you probably know a few others, but what your thoughts are in terms of their level of security and how much information do they transfer to advertisers and so forth.
Yeah, and DuckDuckGo and Brave have been two options that a lot of people have really recommended for privacy, both in terms of limiting what's shared with third parties, but also what they collect themselves. I think that being said, there are even options within other browsers commonly used, whether it's Microsoft Edge or Google Chrome or Firefox. There are also options in those browsers to actually limit what's provided to advertisers for specific websites that you visit. You can actually get extensions that you might even be able to use within those browsers for DuckDuckGo and really limit that data being shared. And that's kind of the goal, is not putting that information out there. And if you're using a search engine, what are they able to do with those accounts? So I think they're good options. I think with any browser, there are still ways to track information when you're viewing a website. I think one of the best benefits you can do if you're using kind of a more secure browser that tries to limit the third-party information that's being shared with all these vendors is to also use a virtual private network or a VPN. Because if I access, let's say, Facebook from DuckDuckGo or Brave, it's probably not going to do a whole lot. Facebook's still going to know the IP address. They're going to know I'm coming from a certain internet connection. They might know from other third parties that are sharing information what other services that I'm using. Using a virtual private network or some kind of proxy service could also help to anonymize a little bit more of that information. So it's harder to tie those pieces together. It doesn't make it impossible, but it does kind of reduce the chances they're going to be able to pair all that data together and say, this is the information for this one person. So I do recommend, any tools you can use to limit your data shared online and to improve privacy. I think DuckDuckGo and Brave are great options. I think virtual private networks, in addition to that, are also great. And actually using even private browser windows are also helpful for Firefox, Chrome, and other items, because they do limit what's shared with certain extensions in your browsers, but also what data resides on your system once you've completed browsing. So those are all great options.
Okay, great. Thank you, Frank. Matthew in La Crosse, what's your question?
Hi, I'm calling in regards to, I own a, well, I don't own it anymore. I mean, I still own it, but I don't use it. I have a Motorola Z3 phone. And one of the things that I did is I did transfer most of the stuff onto my new Moto G5G phone. Thing is that I forgot the pattern lock on the old phone. I didn't have a code in there where I have on the phone that I have now. I had a pattern lock where you'd have to do the pattern to unlock your phone. Is there any way to get into a phone like that without having to do a whole factory reset?
Ooh, that is a good question. Off the top of my head, I don't know a way to easily get in. Most phones will have a reset option so you can get back in. The downside is it probably works against what you want to do, which is to get some information from that device. Once you do that kind of reset, generally you're wiping that device. So it would allow you to get in, but you wouldn't have any of the information that you would need. The only other item that you can take a look at might be different reset options with Motorola, depending on how it's paired with your Google account, if anything. And they might have a recovery mode. But I think even that recovery mode, once again, is a data wipe, factory reset, which also kind of works against what you're trying to do. So off the top of my head, I don't know of a good option, because most of those resets may wipe the data.
Get into the phone without doing the pattern lock to begin with, be able to even access those reset setups. And I'm like, what the heck? Or I don't know how to do it. I thank you for answering my question, because you're like the third answer that pretty much told me, no, dude, you're screwed.
Yeah. And usually there's a specific, for a lot of the items, when you don't have access to like a user interface, you have to press the power button in a certain way with, you know, different switches on the device, and it'll bring up a secret menu. But once you get to that secret menu and try to reset it, it's going to delete the data. So there are ways to get to it, but I think it's unfortunately going to work against what you're trying to do.
Sorry for the bad news, Matthew. Let's go back to Perry and in Oconomowoc. Go ahead, Perry.
Yes, I got two questions now. The first one is probably just a real brief one, but it's going back to the browsers. Can you have too many browsers downloaded on like a desktop computer? Because I use two of them, but I got other ones on there, and I would like to try that Brave also.
I guess in theory, yes, but I wouldn't be too worried about having multiple browsers. I think by default, I usually have at least three browsers on my device. You usually have at least one built into your operating system, whether it's going to be Safari or it's going to be Edge. And I tend to use different browsers as well. So unless you have hundreds of them, which I don't even know if there are hundreds of browsers out there, I wouldn't be too worried about it. I think actually having different browser options is a good idea. One, if you have issues with accessing a website, it could be a good troubleshooting step to see, does it work in a different browser? But it can also be really good when you're accessing different resources. It can show like you're a different individual, even if you're coming from the same network. So it can actually help in some ways to anonymize who you are if you're coming from different browsers. It's not foolproof, but it can help. So yeah, short answer, I think having multiple browsers is a good idea.
Okay, thanks, Perry. Jesse, I did want to ask you about some of these recovery scams that are going on out there. If you could explain a little bit about what they are and what people have to watch for, that would be great.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different, well, there's scams kind of happening, unfortunately, all the time. And kind of what we see with most of these scams, they tend to be identity theft types of things. They're trying to break into another individual's account, trying to get information, and then trying to use that information to do something, whether it's break into a service and get your data, or trying to sign you up for something you really don't want. Identity theft is unfortunately pretty common. It's been around for a long time, even before computers. So it's one of those things that people just find new ways to do it. if information stolen, especially things that might be used for financial gain, one of the recommendations I always have for anyone, even if you haven't been scammed, is freeze your credit. If people do get your information, they can't take out new credit in your name. I'd also recommend they have options for minors. So if you do have children, I also recommend freezing their credit. Weird things can happen and credit can be given to people even if it shouldn't be given. And so you never want somebody to find out later down the road when they actually want to get their first credit card that they actually have bad credit, which has happened in the past. And most of the time it's happening in ways probably mostly through email, social engineering. People are just trying to trick people to click on a wrong link, to call a wrong phone number, to give bad information. And so I'm always leery of pop-ups on your device. It tells you, hey, you're infected, please call Microsoft. Generally, it's a little bit more challenging to actually find a person at Microsoft to talk to. It's not usually going to be, hey, 30 seconds, you're talking to somebody, where Microsoft are going to fix your thing. It's usually a scam. So it's always being a little bit more aware of who you're communicating with. Are they legitimate? And should they even have the information they're asking for? And that could be credit card information. That could be social security numbers or other sensitive personal data that they might want. If you don't think they have a need for it, or you're not even sure it's the right people on the other end of the phone or the email, I would hesitate to give that information because it's usually going to be used for something bad.
Mm-hmm. And just as a, if you think you've been scammed, you want to make sure you call the consumer protection people here in the state, and that number is 800-422-7128. That's 800-422-7128. And we do have them coming on. Michelle will be back with us next month. So if you've got any questions, you can give us a call then too. Let's see, a couple more minutes here. Let's go to an email. Todd, real quick, Jesse. Todd said that he has a 3-month-old MacBook Air computer and the disk failed yesterday. What might be the cause of this disk failure? Any ideas real quick?
Yeah, unfortunately, things fail sometimes. And this can happen when we talk about backups and having backup hard drives. I've had hard drives that have not failed after 10 to 15 years of use. I've had them fail after a week. And sometimes it's a little bit of bad luck. But you'd never quite know, so having a backup is important.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Jesse, for being with us. We really appreciate your time. We'll see you again in 2 months.
Sounds great.
We've been talking with Jesse LeGrue. He's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. I'm Jill LeJoe. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Join us again tomorrow, and stay well.